We'll call the Tax Committee to order for March 19th, 2015. Welcome to the Tax Committee, Senator Sharon. I see you have the cities of Mankato and North Mankato represented with you this morning. So we will start with Senate File 1451. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Skoy and committee members, for hearing our proposal this morning. I am looking through the committee to see what faces are here that might have been here in 1993. I think Senator Skoy, Senator.
Not that old.
No?
1993?
You haven't been here that long?
Does she mean alive?
Who's alive then? How about you? Have you been here that long, Sen? Nobody wants to admit to this, I guess. Anyway, I guess no one was here, perhaps, then. When we were
Senator
first,
Sharon, that's why we have such interest in the proposal today.
I see. They're starting from ground zero. 1993 was the first time we came in front of the committee to discuss the concept of local option sales tax in Mankato. At that time, it was for the Civic Center Arena that you've heard about several times since that time. Part of the conversation at that time in the legislature was whether or not to even allow local option sales tax. And not only that, but whether or not it would do what it was promised to do, which is to create and restore a tax base in a deteriorating downtown core of a community and provide a facility that would be used on a regional basis. I'm here to tell you that that risk that we took back then paid off, at least in the community of Mankato, where as a result of the legislature's support of that process, we've been able to restore a tax base in a part of the city of Mankato that had substantially slipped because of people leaving the businesses, deteriorating, blighting buildings. We also have had over $47 million of new investment in the old downtown core area, while the new type of retail development has been built up on the of the ridge of the community.
And so Senator Sharon, do you recall how large that was, the original request?
The original request for the Civic Center Arena, I don't recall, but our city manager says it was $23 million.
$23 million? Great.
So, it has made that commitment on the part of the legislature to allow Mankato to do that has paid off in spades. And we've come back and we had, in 1996, came back and changed some of the language to also address another regional facility, the Mankato Airport, that for a long time had only been supported on the property taxpayers of Mankato, although it obviously is a facility that serves the entire region's economic development. We're here again with you today for an extension of that sales tax to do a number of things related to the cities of Mankato and North Mankato, some of them in partnership with each other, and some that really provide something that we can do now that we weren't able to do before, and that is to provide the utilization of this in a way that helps communities that surround the cities of Mankato and North Mankato. So with that introduction, I would like you to meet and hear from our city manager, Pat Henches, who will describe what is in the bill, our mayor from North Mankato, Mark Dean, and Patrick Baker, who is the government affairs persons for Greater Mankato Growth. And we also have the city administrator from North Mankato here, John Harrington, who also is willing to come forward and answer any questions you may have.
And who would you like to start with, Senator?
I will begin with Patrick Henches.
Mr. Henches, welcome to the Tax Committee. And perhaps if when you're discussing this, if you would discuss a little bit the need for the two extensions that's in this bill and what your thoughts are with regard to both of those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Henches.
Essentially, we have two components.
Could you say your name so we can identify your voice?
Patrick Henches, H-E-N-T-G-E-S. I'm the Mankato City Manager.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our bill really has two components. The first component is for $29 million worth of authority for regional infrastructure unique to our marketplace. This type of infrastructure includes a series of regional athletic facilities that exist, such as a ballpark, a curling club, some tournament facilities. that we wish to restore, improve, and otherwise develop to a further extent. The included also in that bill includes a series of flood and levee improvements to our system along the Minnesota River that also affects, and these improvements will also relate to costs in incurred by other regional cities such as North Mankato and South Bend Township, a series of water quality improvements, infiltration problems in our surrounding communities, including Mankato, but also Eagle Lake, Madison Lake, those types of things, erosion control problems along the Minnesota River. We are the regional transit system, the city of Mankato itself. We provide transit service to North Mankato and some of the surrounding areas. That transit system, our local taxpayers are supporting at a higher rate, so some facility needs within that transit system. And then some emergency communications for the area, both the city of Mankato, but Blue Earth County, Niklet County, that we are attempting to look at. The second component of the bill is for $25 million of new authority for a series of tournament and recreation facilities that would be jointly shared within the region and work in cooperation with our sister city, North Mankato. And so we're not looking at duplicating these facilities. We will have a series of partnerships with our associations. We'll have probably partnerships with North Mankato, obviously, and probably the Minnesota State University and some of our other higher ed institutions within the area. I would want to emphasize that we are having referendums on both components. There would be a first part referendum on the $29 million and a second part referendum on the $25 million. And that would require voter approval for us to move forward and issue bonds in that standpoint. So essentially, that's the basic features of the bill, very consistent with some of the bills that we've seen in other major regional centers like Rochester, St. Cloud, in terms of the use of the facilities. And I want to emphasize that this isn't all centric to Mankato. There's a lot of joint facilities, but my estimation that about 25% of this sales tax that's collected in Mankato and spent on projects probably will benefit the greater area and actually be spent outside of the city. It's not a direct number at this point, but our estimations, depending on kind of what evolves in those terms of those regional projects. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Henches. And I think I'll just ask the question now as opposed to waiting. So on the list 1 through 6 on page 2, and maybe you don't have that today, but before we move on this, would it be possible to get kind of a breakdown of, you know, what percentage of the money you think would be going to each one of those individual categories?
Mr. Chair, actually I can supply that to your staff today if we make a copy of it.
That would be great. Thank you, Mr. Hedges. And who's next?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Mark Dean, Mayor of the City of North Mankato.
Welcome, Mayor Dean.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of our proposed extension of our local sales tax as well. Our initial legislation was passed in 2006 and approved by the voters by over 70%. We were approved in 5 areas at that time. They included regional parks, library expansion, lake improvements, riverfront development, and then the local share of our new interchange at Highway 14 and 41 that addresses our industrial park. The latter was completed in 2013, and we are now starting to see the fruits of that with new development in our industrial park and some more business interest in the area that we think will come to fruition yet this year, making that provide new jobs and more business opportunity for our community. We did expand our Taylor Library, increasing space and programming for our children, providing more technology for our residents with e-books, et cetera. And we also extended our outreach into the county with our bookmobile system. This is the 50th anniversary of the 1965 flood that devastated North Mankato, and so we are acutely reminded of the benefit of the flood control system that supports both Mankato and North Mankato, and some of these dollars will be used to do the ongoing maintenance required with that now 30-plus-year-old system. Spending our local option sales tax dollars and leveraged with funds from our local United Soccer Fund, we were able to develop a new soccer complex as part of our regional park system. We will be hosting the U.S. Youth Soccer Minnesota State Cup and the Minnesota Youth Soccer Association State Championship this season in their first full year of operation, and that will bring over 250 teams to our area from both throughout the Mankato and greater Mankato area, and then from outside the state as well. We continue to use these dollars towards restoring our 70-acre regional nature park and interconnecting our regional bicycle trail system. And it also supports our Caswell Softball Park, which has been the host of the state girls softball tournament for over 20 years, and we'll be hosting that again this June. In the context of our regional parks, our citizens continue to build a case for a regional multi-sport complex that Mr. Hench has alluded to. We have the various sports of organizations continue to document the shortage of space for hockey, basketball, and other indoor practice facilities. And we believe those are critical to our ongoing economic development as it affects our ability to retain and attract talent to our area that we need for our growing economy down there, so it can continue to support not only the Mankato, greater Mankato area with North Mankato, but also the state with our tax revenues. We have been good stewards of the $6 million that we were originally approved for, and the additional $9 million that we're requesting today will continue to work collaboratively with Mankato and the surrounding area to make those regional amenities part of our community and help us with ongoing economic development. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Baker.
Morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Baker, and I am the Director of Government and Institutional Affairs for Greater Mankato Growth. I'm here on behalf of our President and CEO, Jonathan Zierd, who had another commitment today. So Greater Mankato Growth is the Chamber of Commerce and Economic Development organization serving over 900 members in the Greater Mankato area. And GMG owns and operates Visit Mankato, our local convention and visitors bureau. Both organizations are strongly supportive of Senate File 1451. Our business community and other community stakeholders engage in a process with our city leaders to identify the slate of future regional capital investment priorities included in this bill. And our organization is particularly pleased that the cities of Mankato and North Mankato have come together in a coordinated and collaborative way to advance a single piece of legislation. Our business community is supportive of extending our local sales tax because the investments this legislation makes in public safety, water quality, transportation, regional recreation facilities, and other regional municipal projects are critically important and will allow the community to continue to make strategic investments in the continued vitality of our region. Let me be clear, this is not a tax increase, but a continuation of an existing tax that Mankato and North Mankato have been good stewards of, and that peer regional centers across the state use to invest in key community infrastructure to drive economic development similar to what's requested in this legislation. Let me briefly expand on why GMG is supportive of the investments in regional recreation facilities. Our existing facilities are inadequate to meet the needs of our region. In your materials this morning, you have letters from 8 of our local sports associations detailing their struggles with inadequate recreation facilities. And over the last year, Greater Mankato Growth has led a community visioning process known as Envision 2020. Envision 2020 is a long-range community plan that involves over 300 stakeholders who together define specific goals for the community as a whole to achieve. Improvements to existing recreation facilities and the addition of new regional recreation amenities are identified as a top 5 priority for the community in the Envision 2020 plan. And finally, the projects in this legislation will help make our community and the region an attractive place for individuals to visit and help ensure our businesses can attract and retain the talent they need to fuel our economy. Thank you for your consideration. We look forward to your support of this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Questions, members? Mr. Henches, I'm still a little curious about why we're doing a $29 million extension and a $25 million new authorization as opposed to just doing. I'm not clear on why that we're splitting those two up as they are split up in the bill.
Mr. Chair, our council in the discussion of this, I think, feels that the infrastructure component, the $29 million component, is a little bit clearer in terms of its needs. It's our programming, our immediacy of that item. There is continuing a development discussion regarding the $25 million and the joint recreation facilities in the community, as Mr. Baker mentioned, and that will continue on over the next year. They are very confident that we have the capacity and certainly the needs, but how that shape and develops, I think, is still in its early stages. And so our council is very clear that we wanted to move the infrastructure needs. They're more immediate. And then have a second part question regarding how the $25 million would develop.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's helpful. Thank you. Anything else? Anyone else wish to testify in opposition to Senate File 1451? Thank you very much, Senator Sharon. We will be in touch with you and your city representatives as we put this together. We'll lay this over. I think there's going to be some discussion about some of the projects that are included in here as to whether that would be consistent with what we've done in the past, but we'll continue that conversation. Senator Sharon, do you have any closing comments?
No, but I would appreciate if there is if you have a sense of that you allow me to know where the questions are so that these representatives from the community can help articulate for you why it fits within good policy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Senator Sharon, I think Mr. Henches answered some of it with regard to subdivision C here, or subsection C, in that those are less certain, and so that answers some of it. On article or part one, we do have a few questions about the swimming pool and the athletic fields, baseball park, curling rinks, etc. And so we will certainly be in touch with you.
Thank you very much.
Seeing nothing else, Chair will lay Senate File 1451 over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, Senator
Thank you
Sharon.
Much, Mr. Chair.
Next bill on the agenda is Senate File 1636. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And first, I want to say and recognition that the chair of the Energy Committee is here. Our original intention was to have this heard first in the Energy Committee. It was referred to the Tax Committee because of the tax components in it. We did invite the members of the committee to join us today, but we certainly will be having conversations with Senator Marty and members if they wish. It was my intent to hear this first in that committee. It didn't work out that way. Members, Madam Chair and members, we started this conversation last year as the solar industry was coming in front of the tax committee asking for a production tax that was the same treatment for their electrical generation as the current wind industry has. And so as we contemplated that, we started looking around at other tax treatment for electrical generation. We did a little look at the taconite industry, which has a production tax. And we really decided that we needed to have further information in order to make an informed decision with regard to these electrical generation taxes. We did impose the production tax on solar that was comparable to wind, but I think our thought at the time was that when we got the results of the DOR work over the interim, that we would be revisiting all of these issues. And so we did have a good study done by DOR, a wide variety of participations. We had the report in tax committee earlier this year. And I think that they recognize that production is a pretty good mechanism for assessing taxation on electrical generation. What we currently have on our large coal, nuclear, our gas, our peaking plants really is a mess. There's no consistency to it. The valuations are hard to understand. It's this unitary valuation that takes into account the value of the entire company and takes portions of that and applies it to local values was really hard to understand. So we decided to take a run at making this easier to understand, more streamlined, and something that made sense. And so I have to give the staff a significant amount of credit at this point because it looked pretty easy from my perspective, but I know they spent a lot of time working on this and came up with a pretty good alternative. It really is simply that we would be replacing the current valuation mechanism and replacing it with the production and capacity. Now, I know in our original conversations we thought that there should be about a 70-30 split between these two with regard to electrical generation, but in order to make the numbers work, that ended up being different, closer to 90-10, but it still is based on the production of the electricity that a plant has and the capacity of that plant. And then that translates into a value that is applied to the local jurisdiction's property tax. Plus, there is a factor in here for the spent fuel for these spent fuel casks that there are in the state of Minnesota in order to help recognize that there will be costs associated with those as communities continue to move on. So what the Senate File 1636 does is, and if you're looking at the bill, the majority of the work is probably done in the repealer section because we are repealing the personal property valuation tax on electrical generation. We're eliminating the pollution control and the sliding scale exclusions, eliminating the statutory electrical generation personal property tax exemptions, and we're also eliminating the current wind and solar production taxes and replacing it with a comparable mechanism for determining value that would go into their local community's valuation. So we establish a new capacity generation and spent waste tax base. And in a little bit, I'm going to have Mr. Sylvia walk through some of that formula. But basically, we take the capacity, multiply it by a factor, and get the energy rating for that. We do a generation factor by the generation that they're producing. And those two plus the spent fuel, if it's a nuclear plant, are calculated into a tax base, and then that is what the local value is for taxation. It's hopefully not as complicated as it appears at first, but I think at this point I would like Mr. Sylvia to just walk through the details of the bill And then I think we should go to questions and the testimony, and we will see where this conversation goes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Scoy. Mr. Sylvia.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll just go through kind of a section-by-section brief synopsis. As Senator Scoy indicated, the wind energy production tax is being repealed in this bill, so Section 1 simply deletes a reference to the wind energy production tax. And Section 2 updates the cross-reference from the wind energy production tax that's being repealed to the new section of law that is imposing the tax on facilities, including the wind production tax. Section 3 eliminates a reference to the sliding scale market value exclusion that is also being repealed, and this concerns public utility statutes and commission approval. Section 4 is making a reference to a definition found in the statute concerning cogeneration small power production. This is the definition of high energy distributed generation, and it references the Minnesota statutes 2014 specifically because it's a reference to the determination made under the sliding scale exclusion, which is being repealed, and this is simply a reference that that is determined under the statutes for 2014. Section 5 is eliminating a statute-specific exemption for purposes of the biomass power mandate. As Senator Scoy indicated, the facility-specific property personal property tax exemptions are being repealed, and that strike is a reference to a facility-specific. Section 6 deletes reference to the wind energy production tax under the definition of property tax laws as administered by the Department of Revenue. Section 7 is the section that actually eliminates the personal property tax on personal property, which is part of an electric generating system. Most personal property under statutes is exempt except for those that are listed here, and we are eliminating the reference to the electric generating system. Section 8 is eliminating a cross-reference to the personal property use for pollution control, the pollution control exemption that is being repealed.
See, Madam Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sylvia, there are a few technical errors that we are aware of. If you could point those out when you're going through the bill also. I know that there was some machinery language that was intended to be deleted that is not. If you would point that out when you're going through, I think it would be helpful.
Certainly. Madam Chair and members, Section 9 is the section that Senator Scoy was indicating to, and this is the new valuation for the electric generation machinery. And this section establishes the generation capacity rates, the generation rates, and the spent fuel rates. There is an error found on line 7.10. It should delete the word hour so that it is the generation rate per megawatt. And a capacity generation rate is provided for each type of electric generating system as well as the spent fuel. I should note on line 7.27, the spent fuel tax base should be $100,000 per ton. This references for machinery, but that will be removed in a subsequent edit, so it should be $100,000 per ton. The language is written that the commissioner shall annually determine the value of the operating property, and as Senator Scoy indicated, the tax base is equal to the sum of the facility's nameplate capacity multiplied by the rate as determined under the section. The average production for the immediately preceding 5 years multiplied by the generation rate as well as the spent fuel tax base. This is the value of the property that would then be added to the local jurisdiction's tax base. The remainder of the language found on page 8 and 9 is nearly identical to the language that is currently in the statutes for the wind energy production tax and the solar energy production tax. Because we're repealing those statutes specifically, we move the language that determines the size of those generating systems into the statute. And we do have two notable notations that I should make note of on page 8, line 28. in page 9, line 21, and this specifies that wind and solar energy systems with a capacity of 1 megawatt or less are exempt from the tax.
So, Mr. Sylvia, that language is not new. It's just being moved, in a sense.
Correct, Madam Chair. It was currently in the statute that's being repealed, but it's important.
So it's less new language than it might look like, because and all of the repealers are, well, they start on page 1R, and they're quite significant. I mean, it's 10 pages of repealers. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with regard to the wind, there was a third category that was a mid-range size category for wind that we are eliminating. So the smaller ones will be exempt. Everybody else will be treated the same.
Go ahead. Madam Chair and members, Section 10 eliminates a reference to the personal property tax for electric generation machinery that we discussed. Sections 11 and 12 delete reference to the wind energy production tax from the statutes concerning levy limits. Levy limits are not currently in place, but had they were, there is a factor that concerns the apportionment and the allocation of the wind energy production tax, but that's being removed because we are repealing that statute. Section 13 deletes a reference to the wind energy production tax from the statutes concerning concerning Job Z. Eligible businesses were eligible for an exemption from this tax, but that is being repealed as well. Section 14 is new language, and this provides for transition aid for cities, counties, towns, and school districts that the net tax capacity is reduced because of the changes made in valuing the energy property under this new valuation mechanism. This would provide aid payments for as long as the jurisdiction, as long as and until the jurisdiction's net tax capacity exceeds that of its 2016 net tax capacity. It is written such that if a jurisdiction essentially falls off of the transition aid formula, it would not be eligible to then return back onto the formula. And an open appropriation from the general fund is provided to pay for the transition aid under this section. Section 15 is the repeal that Madam Chair and Senator Scoy had indicated. There are a variety of facility-specific personal property tax exemptions that are being eliminated, as well as the pollution control exemption, the sliding scale market value exclusion, the wind energy, and the solar energy production taxes.
Senator Scoy, the revenue estimate has a number of total hit for the general fund of $5.26 million. Is that the transition aid?
Madam.
And how many local government entities do you anticipate will see a decrease in their net tax capacity that who are going to need the transition aid? And how did what was the thinking in coming up with where are these put in a particular area? Or what are the characteristics of the local governments that are most likely going to receive transition aid?
And Madam Chair, there really isn't a consistent answer to that question. Take the nuclear plants, for example, the two of them. They have a completely different thank you, Steve. They have completely different results. It was just pointed out to me there's 91 local taxing districts.
I see it now. Districts. Yes, okay. I didn't read that far enough down.
But what I would like to say, this $5.2 million is the transition aid, and our goal here was for the local communities to not have a negative impact on their budgets, on their value that they levy against. And so where there were reductions, the state is proposing to pay those off until the community gets back the value that it had at the time that this change was made. And that could be quite a while, or it could be a short period of time. We just don't know.
But Senator Scoy, if you did some sort of, you know, scatter thing of the state of Minnesota map, is the impact felt more in one area in terms of decrease in tax capacity, or is it where these facilities are that I'm trying to think? Okay, so it's 91 that are being anticipated. Are they in central Minnesota mostly, or northern, or are they all over? And it just depends on what kind of energy production facilities exist in any given local community.
I don't think it's geographic, but okay. there is a change for those that had the gas exclusion. As the companies lose the exclusion, the company's tax would go up. We're now in the process of analyzing how their payment in lieu that they were voluntarily making into the community subtracts off of that increase. So that plays into it. But the other area I did want to mention, with the conversion that we used for wind, those communities, there will be a slight decrease. I want to make sure I say this right. If it's either in tax or value. And we didn't intend that, but we didn't want the wind and solar to have a higher multiplication factor than the other industries. So because we had to lower their factor down a little bit, they did receive an unexpected slight reduction for wind than what they currently have.
Okay, any other questions or comments for Senator Scoy or Mr. Sylvia before we go to the testimony? Seeing none, Mr. Peterson, Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, under the current system, there's something called the wind power production tax, and that goes to, I think, counties and perhaps townships, but not to schools. Would this new formula that you have would part of that go to schools?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Senjum. Yes, you know, we had a pretty good discussion about this, and we decided to treat wind and solar consistent with the other electrical generation facilities in the state. So we did move them to a value mechanism that would go into all the jurisdictions, township, county, and school district.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Peterson. And Chris Kunkel, if you'd also please come forward, if you're here. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bradley Peterson. I'm with the firm of Flaherty and Hood, representing the Coalition of Utility Cities. Seven communities: Becker, Cohasset, Hoyt Lakes, Granite Falls, Oak Park Heights, Monticello, and Red Wing, all of which host large electric generation facilities. If you recall the presentation from the Department of Revenue on the utility study, they showed six communities who had significant tax base tied up in this electric generation machinery. All of those communities on that list are some of the ones that I represent. And so this has a significant impact on these communities. For a long time, the maintenance of the personal property tax on electric generation machinery has been a critical contributor to our community's tax base. And the maintenance of this as a contributor to these communities' tax base has really been an article of faith for our organization. And so the migration away from the personal property tax is a big thing for our folks to get their head around. The changes contemplated in Senate File 1636 are paradigm-shifting, game-changing, and earth-shaking. And I was trying to think of an analogy this morning to impress upon you the significance of this change, and I really couldn't. But nonetheless, you know, we'd like to thank Senator Scoy for initiating this very thoughtful and creative discussion about the future of taxation as it relates to these facilities. It is clear to our communities that many of the issues that we have brought forth to this committee in the past are looking to be addressed here in terms of the volatility that the personal property tax and the various exemptions and exclusions over the years have provided for our communities. And so we really appreciate the effort here, and we take this as a very serious proposal, and we're looking at it very seriously ourselves. Also, I want to note from the perspective of Red Wing and Monticello, the two nuclear facilities in the state of Minnesota, you know, one of the items that got a lot of discussion during the Department of Revenue's study process was the legacy costs and the uncertainty of what happens because of their hosting spent nuclear waste. And currently, there really is no mechanism by which the communities on a long-term basis can derive any value to provide services, assuming that those cask storage facilities are going to be in their communities for decades to come. And this proposal by Senator Skoy does attempt to address that. And so we appreciate the recognition of that as a significant driver of uncertainty in at least two of the communities that we represent. Just a couple of things to note sort of going forward in terms of maybe how this would work. In concept, I think it's a pretty straightforward proposal. But obviously, there's a lot of detail that needs to be worked through. And one of those is, as we tried to model what this would mean for our communities, it was not entirely clear from the statute itself sort of what some of the sources of data were and where one might be able to find consistency and what is ensuring consistency and accountability of the inputs in terms of production and capacity in terms of the language itself. And so that's one thing that going forward we'd like to see sort of maybe more clearly spelled out, sort of who's going to be responsible for collecting that data and ensuring that it's consistent amongst facilities. I think our communities also need a little bit more clarity, I think, in terms of the transition aid language and how it would work. But I would note that the concept is not that dissimilar to what was done in 2008 in response to Department of Revenue rule changes that was significantly impacting the valuation of these plants. At that time, the state paid some transition aid to these communities to smooth out the impact of the changes, and this would be very similar to that, and we're appreciative of that as well. In looking at, you know, there are trade-offs in this legislation. One of the most significant pieces of this is that it does address the downside of the depreciation that's currently in the rules. And that has been a big concern of our folks. By taking it out of the personal property tax, you're sort of removing that whole valuation system and the depreciation, which was driving down the market value. However, it does sort of make the upside somewhat static as well in terms of the production and capacity pieces of this. You know, right now, as the utilities are upgrading their plants and making changes at the plants and putting in new equipment, there's a significant bump in value, at least for a time period, and then through depreciation that decreases. However, with this, we at least anticipate that the sort of upside is going to be pretty static, and so there wouldn't be any sort of inflation or anything related to that. And so that's something that we're trying to get our mind around, those two trade-offs, the downside depreciation and the lack of upside in terms of when new equipment is added. You know, one of the things that I think keeps our city officials up at night is what happens in 20 or 30 years when some of these plants either will be shut down or significantly changed in terms of the fuel source. And that's a problem that keeps them up at night under the current regime. And I think it's one that, you know, as we're discussing significant changes to this, we may want to look at that aspect of it. I think actually Senator Senjum said it, you know, very well when we were talking about the Department of Revenue study. Somebody had said to him, I think, that, you know, we talk a lot about what happens when we put these things up. We don't talk a lot about what happens when we take them down. And so regardless of whether this goes forward, that is a discussion that I think our communities will be interested in having here in the next year or so. You know, what happens at these plants there is very important to our communities. In the case of Becker, just the machinery alone, the electric generation machinery that we're talking about, is 50%, almost 50% of their tax base in the community. And so this is a high-stakes discussion for the communities that we represent. But like I said, we really appreciate the thoughtfulness of this proposal, the creativity of this proposal, and to the extent that the discussion is ongoing, we want to be a partner with Senator Scoy and with all of you and with the utilities and with the Department of Revenue to further clarify and refine it. Thank you.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the first thing I would like to say to the whole cities is I served on the school board in Clearbrook-Gonvick and then a county commissioner. The city of Clearbrook is a terminus for a large number of pipelines. It's a very large tank farm there. I am familiar with the issues related to having large facilities dependent on personal property tax in your communities. So I'm sympathetic to what your host communities are saying, hence the number of pieces of legislation that I've carried through the years with regard to host communities. But I do want to say there is, as you mentioned, a downside. When we went through the rate compression of the Ventura years, that was hard on our communities. The changes under Governor Plenty for accelerated depreciation was hard on the valuations. And so there are downsides. There are upsides in that there are expansions. I would want to say that we are contemplating. This is something that just kind of, I don't know if it was an oversight. I hadn't contemplated it. But I currently am contemplating if there is some kind of mechanism that would be an inflationary adjustment. My current thought process is if we could tie it some way to the electrical rates so that the utility would have some ability to understand what it was going to be because they would go for rate increases. We're working on that. So we are trying to address that issue for the future because you don't want this to be a static value either.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any questions or comments, Mr. Peterson? Seeing none, Mr. Kunkel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 1636. My name is Chris Kunkel. I'm the regional policy manager for Wind on the Wires. Wind on the Wires is a nonprofit organization whose members include wind developers, construction firms, turbine manufacturers, other supply chain businesses. Although Wind on the Wires and our member companies are still fully vetting this proposal, I did want to come in today and share a couple of our initial thoughts about it. As with any other industry, taxation plays an incredibly important role in how and where projects are sited. And it's important to, when we're talking about wind and solar and things like that, important to recognize that the state of Minnesota has done much to encourage that development to take place here and not in neighboring states. Smart policies like the renewable energy standard, various forms of regulatory reform. And we think that the stability provided by the current wind production tax has done a good deal to encourage that investment here. Now, under the current wind production tax, large wind systems are taxed at $1.20 a megawatt hour. This is uniform across the state, and it's paid directly to the state and then redirected back to local host communities. To Senator Senjum's point, 80% to the host county and 20% to the host township. Wind farms are a little bit unique in that they can span several different townships and even several different counties. That's what makes the stability of the wind production tax, which again is uniform, so appealing. And just for a little bit of additional perspective on the wind production tax, since it's been in place, or I'll just say 2015 is going to be a very important year for the wind production tax. Since it's been in place, payments will exceed $50 million in the state this year. In 2015, they will exceed $10 million in this year alone to local communities. These are dollars that help pay for vital services, help them hold the line on property taxes. Wind developers pride themselves on being good members of the community. And one of the best ways to do that, local tax payments as well as land lease payments are a great way to do that. So as we, you know, under this proposal, the actual mechanism would be modified for how local tax payments are assessed. But it's very, the last thing that the wind companies want to do is reduce the, or have these local communities see reduced revenues. So that's why we appreciate the transition aid aspect of this. Again, we think that it's absolutely critical as the committee continues to consider this, that payments made to some of these local communities are consistent. Our developers have made commitments to these people, and it's important that, you know, that those dollars remain the same. Similarly, we appreciate that this proposal recognizes that wind and solar have far fewer externalities than other sources of generation. As a carbon-free resource, the societal impacts are far lesser for a wind farm than they would be for a coal plant, for example. And actually, just to underscore this, I saw a story out of Mower County today that they have saved 5 billion gallons of water as a result of the wind farm that they host. So these are the sort of things that we have to consider when we're talking about externalities and long-term costs of generation sources. That said, I do want to share a couple of initial concerns that I've heard consistently from some of our members. The largest by far is how this will affect long-term power purchase agreements. So when a wind developer wants to build a wind farm, they develop a contract and sell that power to a utility for 20, 25 years. Our concern is, and with that, we know what the taxes are going to be under the wind production tax that helps us determine what the long-term project costs are going to be. So under this proposal, which would subject wind farms to varying tax rates of the different jurisdictions in which the project is located, which could also vary over time, it inherently imposes more risk to these projects in terms of long-term cost. It's difficult to determine what the project cost will be 20 years down the road when developing a PPA if you don't know what the taxes will be 10 years down the road. With the current wind production tax, we know exactly what the taxes are going to be as we, you know, look into developing a power purchase agreement. So, and I do also have one of our member companies here today, actually two of them, Iberdrola, Adam Skolsky from Iberdrola Renewables, and Betsy Engelking from Geronimo Energy, that'll be testifying after me, that can provide a little bit of more company-specific information and perspective, I think. But I do want to thank this committee again for allowing me to speak on this proposal. We certainly look forward to continuing to work with Chair Skoy and members of this committee to craft what is, from my perspective, a very forward-thinking proposal, tax proposal, and hopefully something that will allow Minnesota to continue to be a leader on wind energy. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions or comments from Mr. Kunkel? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Kunkel, when you were talking about the stability of the long-term purchase power agreements, are those set up in such a way that they are structured to go up and down with unavoidable costs such as your tax rate and so on?
That would be a great question to ask Mr. Sikolsky, who will be following me.
Thanks.
Senator Skoy.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And one of the things that I would say to the committee is that the property tax is one of our most stable. I mean, we don't see the large swings in that. I think the one issue that might happen at a local level would be if there was a school building bond or something. That could potentially have an impact if we, you know, were moving forward with this valuation mechanism. But otherwise, the property tax is relatively stable.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kunkel. Mr. Sikolsky and Betsy Engelking. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Senator Rest, members of the committees. My name's Adam Sokolsky. I work for Iberdrola Renewables. We are a developer, owner, and operator of wind farms across the United States, including about 550 megawatts of wind farms here in Minnesota. I think that's six sites in southwestern Minnesota that we own and operate. And the oldest one being, I believe, 2004 when we built it. Do you want Ms. Engelking to introduce herself at this point?
We'll just take your testimony first.
Good. As I said, I work for Iberdrola Renewables. We're a large wind farm owner, operator, and developer. We own projects all across the United States with about 5,800 megawatts of wind farms in the U.S. We're based in Portland, Oregon. And we've invested approximately $1 billion here in Minnesota in wind generation. We appreciate the opportunity to come today and provide some comments and ask some questions about Senate File 1636. This is a bill that fundamentally really restructures how wind farms are valued here in Minnesota for tax purposes. And it's important to think as a committee and as a legislature as well that when you look at some of our neighboring states that are very windy, that folks like Ms. Engelking and myself look at, North Dakota is embarking right now on changes to their tax systems for wind farms. We just completed a major overhaul in South Dakota to get their tax code for wind farm operating taxes to be competitive. It was broken severely. And it's interesting now that we're bringing this up here in Minnesota in terms of big overhaul. So it's an important time. A lot of other states are doing the same thing right now. And we think that's really important to think kind of regionally as well, to make sure we stay competitive here in Minnesota. Chris stole a little bit of my thunder, so I'm going to just skip across a couple things. The important message I want to get out to you today is it's really, really important to get wind taxes right. I referenced South Dakota. I referenced how broken their tax system has been up until last Friday for wind farms on an operating basis. Projects in South Dakota were, frankly, completely uncompetitive in the market we're in here due to their high operating taxes. You put out an RFP like Xcel Energy did back in 2013, said, hey, come one, come all, give us your wind, give us your best prices, and you see 60 projects respond. You see dozens of developers respond through Iowa, Minnesota, North and South Dakota, Wisconsin. And in the end, when the XL comes up with a short list, not a single project to be investigated further came out of South Dakota. Their system was broken. We tried to fix it. It's really important to get this right. Minnesota has been very competitive on the production tax, for wind. The rate has been stable. It's been very clear. It's a very, very simple formula for both us and our host communities to understand what the taxes are going to be for a wind farm, what they should expect in revenue year in and year out, year one or year 20. That feeds also, as Chris said, into our power purchase agreements. We sell the vast majority of the energy we produced through long-term power purchase agreements with reputable Minnesota-based, largely, but regionally-based utilities. Some of those contracts can be very, very short, but by and large, when you're building a wind farm, you're expecting to have at least a 10-year power purchase agreement that would specify that we're going to sell all of our energy to a certain utility for a certain cost. That can be a flat cost. That can be a cost that's indexed for inflation. That can be a scheduled cost that goes up or down every year. But we know what we're going to be selling for and approximately how much wind we're going to have every year. It varies a little bit, but we generally know roughly what we're going to have for wind production year in and year out. With a production tax like we've had in Minnesota, we're able to schedule that in and understand for then each unit of production, we're taxed a certain amount. So we think production and to a certain extent capacity are really good metrics for wind. South Dakota uses now a combined production and capacity tax system, and it works. It's going to work really well. So I think we're on the right metrics here. The important thing for us is this new, and it's a concern, the new tax system would open us up to two new taxing jurisdictions, as we understand, And one of those has big, bond issues like that school districts have. And so we're concerned about tax rates changing over time. We know that property taxes are fairly stable, but then there's, of course, the year or two where there's something big that comes in for a new school or a new public infrastructure project that may impact taxes. And that causes us concern because it's very difficult to project those over a 10 or 20-year period. That may cause companies like ours to overestimate or misestimate those tax increases that may occur down the road. That may, if we're overestimating those, then we may become uncompetitive with some of our competitors. If other competitors underestimate those, they might not be making a profit anymore, which is kind of their fault, but it's a concern. The other concern we have, and we want to bring this up with staff kind of offline as well in more detail, we're not real experts in how property taxes are distributed and some of the formula that go into local property tax rates and state distributions and aids. And so we want to talk through some of those issues. We had to actually rebuild our tax model that we built on Monday. We had to rebuild it on Tuesday evening because we found some problems in the way we built it. So we wanted to see what our local host communities should be receiving under this new formula. And so we want to talk through with staff a little bit and to see, just check our math to make sure we're right. Because that's an important piece for us is, again, those local communities are using their tax revenues from wind to do a variety of things, a lot of public infrastructure, roads and bridges. And some of the counties have been in a state of disrepair, and they've been using the funds in particular on the bridge side. But also a couple of the counties we've been involved with have taken the wind production tax revenue that they've received to date and actually lowered their overall property taxes for all landowners in the county. And we're kind of thinking through what kind of mechanisms, if we changed the valuation formula, would that then cause them to change their rates locally and then change those rates to change for us under the new formula?
Do you have an example of a county that's done that?
Jackson County has done it.
Which county?
Jackson County, Minnesota, has used some of the production tax revenue to reduce their property tax rates. They've also used some for bridge projects and I think partially funding a upgrade to, a rebuild of their road maintenance facility. So that's a concern that we want to understand better. And it's not as a fault of the bill. It's just we're not experts in that matter. And we want to be able to say with some confidence, here's what the local impact might be and make sure our math is correct on that. Finally, and I think Mr. Peterson brought up some good concerns, I think the host communities, we really need to listen to them and talk to them about what's going to be happening there. And I know Senator Scoy has been doing the same thing. And he talked about that with us here just the other day with Clear Brook and the big pipeline hub there. Talking through with, how are those communities using the money? What a valuation change, especially on the wind side, would mean to them and what other implications it might have. I frankly can't list those all out, but we are concerned about a couple of those that we want to dive into greater detail with staff. Just because we're in a little bit of a gray area there. But we do think, production is for wind is really the right metric to be basing taxes off from on an operating side. We're excited about the regional discussion on taxes right now. It's exciting. It's good that everyone's kind of jumping in at the same time. And we really want to be part of this process. We want to make sure this is done right. We think this is a really interesting, novel approach, and we want to just kind of chase down some of these concerns we have. So we look forward to working with you, Senator Scoy, and members of the Tax Committee on this issue throughout the rest of the legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments for the witness? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe for Senator Scoy or for Mr. Sokolsky. Under Minnesota law now, do the production tax revenues in one way or another benefit our schools, or would they be adding into now the participation in those revenues, and do we really want to make that change?
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Ortman, currently the distribution is 80% counties, 20% towns. What this changes is we're not adding capacity. The tax is still totally based on production, but the change is that we would put it into the value of the local jurisdictions, so all of the jurisdictions' tax would be impacted by that, which would include school districts, and it wouldn't be split 80-20. It would be split based on what the values are in the county versus the township, I guess.
Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair, if Mr. Sikorski could also answer
Mr. Sikorski.
Mr. Chairman, rest us, Senator Ortman. And I can't remember which year it was, but several years ago, six, 8 years ago, the wind production tax used to also be apportioned or sent to school districts. I think the split used to include, I think, 12% for school districts, and that was between 2002 when the wind production tax was enacted, and I think about 2006 or 7. And there was a discussion up here at the legislature about some school districts were receiving a windfall, and there was some fairness issues discussed. We did not dive into that those arguments, but the tax distribution formula was changed, took schools out, and then arrived at the 80-20 split, which we currently have today.
Senator Skoy.
My recollection is that I was part of that conversation. Some of the discussion revolves around, as you take value out of the schools, the state will pick that up in equalizing. So it's not really an impact on the school. It is an impact on the state. So and every school district's different depending upon their valuations. So, but what I do want to say is, first of all, I have no intent to negatively impact renewables. I mean, I just clearly don't want to do that. The result here of what this proposal is probably a slight increase in risk, but it actually does result in a slight reduction in the tax. And so, you know, there is that offset that has to get taken into account. I do think consistency across all of electrical generation is important, and that's why we went down this road with wind and solar. And to be honest, back 6 years ago and farther when this conversation of the production tax was taking place, it wasn't without discussion and controversy as to is this the mechanism to use. And so when the solar came last year asking for that, we did place the tax on solar, but with the understanding that we were going to take a look at it to see if that really was truly the best mechanism. So I know you guys are kind of hung up in this change. We're trying to make it as minimal as we can. We certainly don't want to do anything to negatively impact, and we look forward to working with you on this. But I think consistency does have value also, so I'd like that to be kind of part of the conversation here. And just one other thing about the renewables, and I don't want to jump on anybody's thunder because I probably should let the testifiers both go. I really, truly appreciate their approach to the not in my backyard syndrome, in that they are confident and comfortable in contributing into their communities to positively impact the by paying property taxes into those communities so that there is less of the opposition to not in my backyard. And I really think you guys are doing a good job with that.
Thank you, Senator Skoy. Senator Ortman, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you. Senator Skoy, are you intending any kind of adjustments to equalization aid or aids to cities and counties, townships, if you're going to make these adjustments and they are reduced in revenue or raised in revenues?
I haven't planned on doing that. That's part of the valuation that goes on, and it'll flow through the formulas as it flows through. My expectation is that there will be no local community, because of the transition aid that's in here, losing revenue. There might be some gainers, but nobody will lose.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Betsy Engelking.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Betsy Engelking, and I am with Geronimo Energy, an Edina-based wind and solar developer, develops projects in the Upper Midwest. Geronimo is the developer of the Aurora Solar Project, which is a 100-megawatt distributed solar project that will be spread over 24 sites and 16 counties in the state of Minnesota. And first of all, I want to echo the comments that were made by my colleagues on behalf of the wind industry, and also wanted to provide a little bit of perspective on behalf of solar development in the state. Your session started this morning with a question of how many of you were here in 1993, and I don't know that we had any takers, but you know, 1991 is actually when the property tax exemptions on wind and solar were passed in Minnesota. in order to spur development in the state. And as development of wind came to fruition, I think people discovered that energy projects need to support the localities and the counties in which they operate, first of all, because they do put additional stress on the infrastructure and the services provided by the counties, as well as, hosting those types of projects, definitely provide benefits to the counties, and wind is being developed in some of the poorest counties in Minnesota, and they've truly benefited from it. We actually came before you last year and asked you to institute the production tax on solar. The exemption on solar had still existed since 1991, and we asked to institute the production tax because of our Aurora project and because we believed firmly that we should be compensating the communities in which our projects were being constructed. We believe that the production tax is a very easy tax to apply. It's very understandable for us. It's very understandable for the counties. It's easy to calculate. We do it once. We send our numbers to the Department of Revenue. When you look at a solar project or something like our Aurora project that can be spread over a number of different counties, that introduces a lot of variability in the taxes for that project. And it will be interesting. We haven't even gotten as far as building a model, or Adam's a little step ahead of us, but we haven't even gotten as far as building a model to see what kind of impact that might have or what kind of risk and variability. But obviously in this change from thermal plants to what Senator Scoy is proposing is a very large change for them, from something that's maybe a little more uncertain to something that's a little more stable for communities. And I think you're getting a different result for renewables. You're moving from something that's pretty stable and certain for communities to something that's a little more uncertain. I think it's interesting right now. I'm involved in a coalition of energy producers in North Dakota that are trying to do the same thing as this bill, which I think is admirable, and that is to sort of equalize taxes over energy production facilities. And they're actually moving to a production tax that's based more directly on capacity and energy production than something that would actually use that as a valuation and moving to a mill rate as this bill is. And I think a lot of states around the country have held up Minnesota as a good model on how to tax renewables in a production manner. We really appreciate the intent of this bill. We really appreciate what it's trying to do for communities to ensure a stability of their tax revenues. We think that it probably needs some more study and some more work, and we also look forward to working with Senator Scoy, members of the committee, and other interested parties in putting together something that will work well for all communities.
Thank you. Any questions or comments from Ms. Engelking?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Just briefly, we did look at a production tax. North Dakota does not have the diversity of energy sources that Minnesota has. The shifting was just more than we could bear without bringing the value mechanism in, and we just couldn't move forward with just a production tax.
Thank you very much, the two of you. And now Xcel Energy would like to weigh in. Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Grania McKiernan. I'm with Xcel Energy. Xcel is the largest property taxpayer.
You need to move the mic closer and speak louder.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Xcel Energy is the largest property taxpayer in the state at about $185 million this year. So this is an important issue to us, and we appreciate the work and the resources that went into putting this bill together. It's a huge, major initiative. Overall, as we understand the bill, it seems to be a very good approach to valuing energy facilities. It meets a lot of the state's policy objectives in terms of providing a simpler, more understandable method and process, and providing uniform treatment, as has been raised, to the treatment of energy-producing property. And importantly, for us, it addresses some of the issues that have been before this committee for many, many years, between the trying to balance the host community concerns about fluctuating revenues and our concerns about the property tax levels. This new methodology would stabilize the value of our electric generation machinery. So revenues to host communities would be stable and predictable. Our tax revenues wouldn't go up when we make investments, as they currently do, but they wouldn't. Revenues to host communities wouldn't decline. So the trade-off, as the Coalition of Utilities cities provided, we would echo. You know, that is the trade-off. The downside for us would be that it would single utility property out for a production tax, although we do have our property is comparable to other industries. However, it builds on the tradition of taxation of utilities in that way. I'd like to clarify that this mechanism would replace the current unit valuation method for personal property, but it doesn't affect that fact that we pay real property taxes on our land and buildings in all these host communities. So that would continue. We still, like other industries, pay local property taxes on our land and buildings for local services. We would estimate that the impact on our plants of this proposal would initially be about a 9% increase on the generation equipment value for 2014. So in response to your question, Madam Chair, the characteristics of the impact are more related to the characteristics of the plant. The baseload plant communities would see increases. The peaking plants would see reductions. And overall, depending on the local rate, it could increase as well.
Can I interrupt?
Sure. So, discussion.
I'm sorry. Could you explain
Senator
the peaking?
Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you explain the peaking plants receiving the reduction?
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, because the new value under this bill would be based on production, and the peaking plants produce less, those communities would see lower revenues.
Senator Scoy.
Yes, Madam Chair, but offset by their loss of the exclusion. And then it's also confounded by any voluntary bill payment that they might be making.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that would be accurate.
Excuse me, Ms. McCarran.
I'm sorry.
Senator Gazelka, on this point.
I'm sorry.
Well, the 9% that she just talked about, Madam
okay.
Chair.
Okay. Senator Gazelka.
Madam Chair, thank you, the testifier. You talked about a 9% increase. I want to make sure I understand what that does, and does that impact the ratepayer? That's the part I want to know. And the other thing I just want to say, so I don't have to speak twice, I'm glad you brought up the property tax thing, because I wasn't sure how that worked. And the actual land, that's still a big chunk of money that's being paid out. So, but if you can help me on that, what happens to the ratepayer with that 9% you talked about, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Senator Gazelka, the ratepayers pay for the property tax costs that are, imposed on plants on our property.
So, Madam Chair, I guess I'm trying to get a sense of, because I like the concept of this, I'm just trying to get a feel for, but does it increase what the ratepayer is going to pay?
Madam Chair, Senator Gazelka, the initial impact as we've calculated it or estimated it would be about a 9% increase initially. However, because it's based on production, and not any future investment, it would eventually even out. Okay. As we invest under the current system, as we invest in plants, our taxes go up because the value goes up. Mm-hmm. And it goes up significantly because this is very highly valuable machinery, $200 million for a generator, for instance. that would no longer be the subject of the valuation. So it would be a trade-off.
So, Madam Chair, so long-term, you're basically saying it's a wash, but I totally get what you're saying now, so thank you.
Yep.
Senator Skoy.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess to Senator Gazelka and the committee. When we were setting this up, we thought, according to the information that we had, that the total statewide impact would be about $7 million of loss to local governments. We weren't too far off on that. The revenue estimate has 5.9. We are a little, we don't understand exactly the increases that some of the utilities are talking about. Our data statewide showed about a $7 million increase across the state for all utilities. Now, my original talk about there no consistency, there's wide swings between facilities within that $7 million. Some are up, some are down. For a large company like Xcel, some would be up and some would be down and overall would average out. We need to delve into some of these numbers. And I'm going to say it right now so I don't forget. Mr. Hurd has asked me at the end of the meeting today to indicate to the stakeholders that we're going to have a sign-up sheet outside. We're going to start some email correspondence back and forth with people trying to get an understanding around this very issue.
Thank you.
Ms. McKiernan, continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The one question we would raise about the bill, maybe two, is it is not clear how it interacts with the current unit valuation method. If it doesn't replace it, then it would appear to be an extra step, which would raise concerns for us. One way that we would suggest or we could recommend, and I've mentioned this to Senator Skoy, that we may be able to replace it is to also address the transmission and distribution. Those are the other components of the unit in the unit valuation method. And if there was a similarly simple way to value those, then we could get away from what is a very complex and confusing valuation method that we're currently under. So we have that question, and in addition would be interested in hearing further information about the inflator that was just raised a bit ago. If I could raise one issue I'd like to address, Mr. Peterson from the Coalition of Utility Cities mentioned the nuclear issue. We really appreciate the effort here to find a rational basis for taxing the spent fuel facility. But I did want to say that in the back of the Department of Revenue's report of electric generating facilities, there's an addendum that identifies all of the federal and state regulations that require us to provide adequate funding for management of the spent fuel facility for the life of the plant, so that as long as there is anything on that property and until it is returned to Greenfield, basically, we are responsible for the management of it, and we are currently setting aside money. It's collected in rates currently, and it's set aside in a separate independent trust fund valued in the billions, I believe, for the management of that fuel. So that would be – that's in addition to the funds that would be collected under this bill. I believe – thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Kiernan. Comments or questions for Ms. McKiernan and Senator Skoy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with regard to the unitary, it's uncertain as to whether we're going to be able to replace that with this proposal. The department is trying to understand that now. That really would be a very, very good thing to do. It's extremely complicated. And if we're not able to put this in place of the current unitary valuation mechanism, I think we should contemplate expanding this to include transmission lines, because then we could accomplish that.
To expand it to include what?
Transmission lines.
I see.
And I'll be with the committee. We started out taking a big bite. We started out thinking about transmission lines and pipelines and electrical generation, and we scaled back because it was getting to be more than we thought we could handle. But we might expand out a little bit to include electrical transmission lines, the high power, or the high voltage ones anyway, and see if that can be helpful in eliminating what the talked about with regard to the unitary issue.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a quick question for Ms. McKiernan before she leaves the table. Regarding that 9% anticipated increase under this proposal, how does that translate into taxpayers? What kind of rate increase would taxpayers see, or ratepayers see? It wouldn't be 9%. What type of rate increase would one anticipate from that? And you said that that was a initial cost, and at some point, as the plants increase their machinery or the equipment, then of course it would become a neutral. What's the time frame between where you think those lines would cross, where the taxes that are avoided under this new system would intersect with the increased tax of 9%? So how's it, what's it translate into ratepayers, and then where's that intersection point? How far down the road is that?
Ms. McKiernan?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, it would not be a 9% increase in our rates. That's
yes,
but
what do you think it would
and
be?
And I'm not able to give you an estimate at this point, but I could try to see if that's something we could run. There are a lot of unknowns here, and so it would be pretty rough estimate to calculate that kind of thing, as it would be trying to contemplate when those lines might meet. It would depend on, you know, the projected investments of new assets at the various plants, and so a lot of factors that I'm not. I can check and see if we could get you
Thank
an
you.
Answer on that. Thanks.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question on that,
Senator Skoy, and then Senator Ordman?
Would the rate have to go through the rate increase have to go through PUC?
All of our. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
That's okay.
Yes, Senator Skoy. All of our rates are set by the PUC. We cannot pass through costs or change our rates without any approval from the PUC. And if this bill progresses, we would be asking for accommodation of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then just one other
Senator
slight
Skoy.
Correction. I think, Senator Nelson, the lines would cross not based on machinery that they added, but on production increases, because this is now a production tax. Nothing to do with what machinery upgrades or any of that. They can do all the machinery upgrades that they feel necessary in a plant. As long as the production doesn't increase, it doesn't change their tax burden, unless they change the buildings or something. But the electrical generation machinery is taken out. That's the value of this change. We're going away from that complicated personal property tax mechanism and going to a production capacity.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Just to clarify on that, I understand that, but I think that if, in fact, the utilities improve through I understood this bill to state that as the utilities improve their production mechanisms, the I don't know if it'd be the machinery or the things that actually produce that energy, as they improve that, I understood that those improvements would not be taxed under the new formula, but they are under the current formula. And so the fact is, as the utilities add these enhancements, then in the new formula, they would no longer be taxed. And so my question was, when does that intersect? And that's why you don't know, because you don't know how much those new improvements are going to be and how much tax would be avoided under this new proposal. And I wanted to know when the intersection was between that and the increase in the rates. Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Just, okay, I didn't understand that.
But I want to make sure I understood you, so thank you.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there an assumption here that the production will increase? And does Excel also anticipate an increase in production?
Ms. McKiernan?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, no, it's likely that the production would stay relatively the same. We have, we have planned outages for some of our plants, so in a given year, a plant might be out for 2 months. That would affect the production and the revenue. Some of our plants may be ramping down. That would affect production and revenue. We've recently made an investment at Monticello, for instance, that did increase the production capacity by 71 megawatts, but for the most part, the production level would stay the same, and that would be one of the benefits of this in terms of the stability of the revenues for host communities.
So it may be some time before your production catches up to this new level of expectation, and the ratepayers will have to pay the difference until that does happen, or are likely to be asked to pay the difference, whether the PUC approves that or not. My second question then is, how many ratepayers would be affected by this? And I know you can only speak to Excel in rough numbers, but I'd be interested to know how many ratepayers will be on the hook, if you will, for these increases.
Ms. McKiernan?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, all utility ratepayers, if it's included in the rates, it would spread across the rate base, and so all ratepayers would pay.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Ortman,
I was looking for a little more specificity. Can you just give the numbers, rough numbers? Is it 25,000 ratepayers will be affected, or 50,000 ratepayers? I mean, I don't know your industry like you do.
Sorry, Ms. McKiernan?
Sorry, Madam Chair. I think that we have about 1.3 million ratepayers, I believe, in XL's service area.
That's why I'm the layperson and you're the expert.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Is that it, Senator
Yes,
Ortman?
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Skoy, and then Senator Senjum, and then you do have other bills on the agenda that maybe we should get to, Senator
sure.
Skoy.
Sure. Just briefly, and I appreciate the conversation. With regard to the production of electricity, I think that, and I don't, Senator Marty will know this better than I do, but my expectation is that the usage of electricity in the state is projected to grow. Now, one of the reasons for doing this is so that as we go into the future and the nature of electrical generation changes to what it's going to be, which we don't know today, we have a mechanism that is simpler and more understandable, and industry and the customers can understand, and the host communities can understand. Because to be honest with you, if you sit down and start analyzing all the exemptions and all the personal property tax changes and all the values, it's pretty tough to get your head around. And the one example, I mean, we have peaking plant in my district just outside of Solway that has an exclusion, and another peaking plant down here somewhere on the west side of the cities that doesn't, and one's paying, you know, almost no tax, and the other one's paying a pretty significant burden. It just doesn't make any common sense. So we're trying to address that, those factors, as we move forward with electrical generation in Minnesota. And you're right, Madam Chair. I know we have other bills right on the agenda.
Yeah, I'm sorry I did that. I apologize. Senator Senjum, did you want to make a comment?
I think maybe, Madam Chair, there were, well, okay, you've invited me.
raised your hand.
It would seem to me, and I won't call Ms. McKernan back up, but we have had debates about, you know, the values of particularly a complex nuclear power plant, and in terms of the local assessor that has to try to put a valuation on that, this is an enormously less complex process, I can imagine. The other thing, and we don't need to talk about it, to Senator Ortman's question, transportation yesterday, we heard that our state's going to grow by a million people or so, I think, in the next 20 years, and so we need good roads and so on and so forth. On the other hand, I just heard that at least XL is not planning on a lot of new production for, you know, to serve those so-called million people. And so there seems to be a little conflict there, unless we're making it up with efficiencies, and we don't need to answer that question today, but I'm kind of curious about that.
Okay. Want to remind people, if you are interested in following up with on this subject and having additional information and entering into a dialogue, our page in the back has a clipboard for you to give us your information. I'm assuming it's a name and a reliable email address, at least. And Senator Scoy, is there anything further you'd like to add at this point?
The only thing I would add for the members is that if we need more committee time on this issue, we can have more time after
right.
the break.
Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to comment briefly that, yes, this is, as we all understand, very complex issue, and to Senator Senjum's thing. And so, yes, it's hard to project where energy direction is going to go. And we are making big improvements in efficiency as well. But I want to thank Senator Scoy and his staff for trying to tackle this, because when Senator Coonan came with the bill last year and the tax committee leadership decided we ought to take a look at this whole thing, the way we've set our utility taxes has been kind of who comes and screams the loudest in some cases. And I think this is a very difficult attempt to try and put some logic and some sense into this. And I think this is really promising, and the helpful comments today will help as well. So thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. There being no further discussion, the chair lays over Senate File 1636. The next bill on the agenda is Senate File 1143, Senator Peterson. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
1143.
Yeah, members, we have before you today Senate File 1143, and I need to offer an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, please,
the
for you to review.
The A1 amendment, is that in members' packets? It is. Senator Nelson moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Which, in effect, deletes Section 1.
Yep.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As the chairwoman just mentioned, it just deletes Section 1. We had a little opposition there in regards to that section from financial institutions, and it really had no effect on the bill, and so we were able to eliminate that to accommodate their concerns. I want to thank the other authors on this bill this morning. We have Senator Scoy, Senator Brown, and Senator Rosen that have all seen fit to help out with this project and help fix this, I believe, a fairly minor problem that we have. Right now, members, Senate File 1143 as amended helps your counties. Right now, they're in a situation where they do not have the same authority as cities and townships do in terms of reviewing land transfers before they happen. And so what this bill does is just give that authority to counties to review subdivisions and give their approval prior to those land transfers, just to ensure that the resulting lots are in compliance with a sale that may be pending. And so we have some testimony today to talk about some examples and some of the challenges this has created for counties, and we hope that you can include this in your bill to get this fixed on their behalf this morning. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am George Leary. I am the Blue Earth County Planning and Zoning Administrator. And very briefly, the comments I would have is that the county's share, and that would be from the Minnesota Association of County Planning and Zoning Administrators, is basically the unintended consequences of property splits that create one or more nonconforming issues. And very briefly, what those could be, and this is not all-inclusive, but the lack of a subdivision plat, possible variances that would be required due to inadequate property line setbacks that resulted from that property split, the possible need for septic review. Septic review is, or septic systems are the wastewater treatment systems out in rural areas that are not serviced by municipal sewer. And in this case, it could require a review of that. And if the system is non-compliant, it could result in a $15,000 or more septic replacement cost to the property owner. So basically, bottom line is we're asking for the same review authority that is given to the municipalities, and to try to avoid these unintended consequences of non-conforming property splits. Thank you.
Any questions or comments for the witness? Seeing none, the chair.
Madam Chair.
It's Senator Scoy.
I have a question on my Senate File 1143. I'm not exactly sure we understand Section 1.
We deleted it.
You deleted it. Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, the chair lays over Senate File 1143 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, members. Senator Dahl and Senator Saxog are tied up in the Education Policy Committee and will not make it. So we're going to lay over. We'll hear Senate File 1147 and 1332 another day. And we will be meeting Monday through Thursday for sure next week.
Yes.
No other business in front of the committee. We're adjourned. Thanks, Anna.